Available now from Graphic Audio.
Attention all hands, attention all hands. This is the captain. I regret to inform all of you that Speaker of the Grand Council, Lord Thornbuckle, is dead. Assassinated on Castle Rock.
It's been confirmed by three separate agencies, Malone.
How many were killed or injured?
Lord Thornbuckle and three security personnel killed. Sir Mahoney is alive, but in critical condition.
A terrible, terrible situation.
Terrible for some, certainly.
So we're too late and somebody got him first.
So what do we do?
Get the rest of them. If he's dead, maybe they won't be watching so close. I could take that yellow-haired slut.
We have a mission. A new mission. Got it?
Yes, sir.
Miranda, what have they told you about it? About who did it?
Nothing. I know the news media says it was the New Texas Militia.
Miranda, I don't think it was the New Tex Militia.
No.
Since Lord Thornbuckle is dead and cannot reply, some might consider it unnecessary to detail the charges that might have been brought against him, but I believe in full and fair disclosure. The fact is, the Familius Regnant is sick, on its deathbed, and if we don't act quickly, the patient could die.
How did Hobart Consuline become Speaker?
I'm Ranger Briley, but you can call me Kate.
What do you make of our Speaker?
He's nobody I'd buy a ranch from. Now, why don't you get down to what you really wanted to talk about?
I want to find out who killed my father, and what kind of hold Hobart Consuline has on my Uncle Hollis, who's after my father's estate.
Now that's a goal we can work on.
We?
Of course we. Hell's bell, sweetheart. I'm not going to leave you to hunt this hog alone. It's time I went to work.
Serrano Legacy, Book 6, Change of Command, Part 1, from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Be careful, Barry.
Don't worry, I'll be right back. My God.
Why am I brought from universe to watch its destruction?
Anyone have any idea what this is about?
I am the Monitor, and I brought you here to save the multiverse.
Only then, in a single, swift, and surprising stroke.
I will kill the man I love.
Damn you! I just wanted to see her one more time!
This is war, Superman.
This ends now!
Why are you fighting me? You're already dead!
I need more power! I need more strength!
It's time for you, your world, and your universes to die!
Iris.
Crisis on Infinite Earths and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2009 DC Comics. All rights reserved.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by David Coyne, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, Tim Getman, Joe Brack, Ken Jackson, Dylan Lynch, M.B. Van Dorn, and James Lewis. Deathlands number 39, Water Sleep.
Brian Cotter was drowning. His chest echoed heavily with the dull thud of a waterlogged pump. He watched the air bubbles float upward, following their path with his good right eye, and tried to focus on what might lie beyond them. At first, he thought his vision was blurred, but then Ryan realized that there was no sky overhead, no clouds, no stars, nothing but water. He squinted and took in a sight his brain logically told him had to be the murky green fluid of the ocean. The green was everywhere, surrounding his entire body and being. Ryan had always imagined the ocean depths as being cold as ice, but he was strangely warm instead. He could almost taste sweat on his lips, but knew the salt on his tongue had to be coming from the seawater. Could a man sweat underwater if the temperature got hot enough? Cook like a fish in a pot over an open fire? Ryan thought it was possible, but he'd have to try to remember to ask Mildred when...
Everyone ready?
Asked Mildred when they ended the jump. Ryan sat on the floor with Christy Roth's hip next to his own. He could see the radiant fire of her long red hair out of the corner of his eye. On his other side, sharing his dark complexion and black curly hair, was his son, Dean. Until recently, the youngster had been a student at the Nicholas Brody School in Colorado, obtaining a much-needed education. Across from Ryan was a young albino with features distinctive enough to bring more than a glancing notice, even among the more unusual appearances in Deathlands. Jack Lauren's pallid complexion was paler than usual, throwing the crisscrossed scars on his face into sharp relief. His ruby eyes were at half-mast, and his mouth was drawn tight in anticipation of the jump to come. Next to Jack's eerie whiteness was the ancient, weathered face of Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner. Doc appeared calm, his lips whistling a silent tune only he could hear, but Ryan noted how tightly he was gripping his ebony sword stick.
Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
The circle of companions was completed by John Barrymore Dix, Ryan's longtime friend, known also as the Armorer, and Dr. Mildred Wyeth. The title of Armorer was one of respect for Dix's encyclopedic knowledge of all forms of weaponry and how they were used. Although they kept their relationship restrained and private, Ryan couldn't help but notice the comforting arm JB had placed around Mildred's shoulders. She leaned back into his side gratefully. Then the mist of the chamber crept into Ryan's brain, interrupting his mental checklist. The tendrils of pale smoke worked their scientific magic, and the jump began. The band of travelers had traversed most of what remained of the United States, and even visited other continents during travels via the gateways. But no matter where they eventually ended up, the one constant in traveling via the Matrans units was the headlong rush into the unknown. Their destination was always yet another gateway chamber with thick armaglass walls. Despite cosmetic changes of color and size, the gateways were always the same. The mystery was in surviving what lay outside the gateway chamber. They had jumped into hell and into paradise, always appearing in the familiar gray setting of an abandoned underground military base, dusty with disuse and littered with the empty boxes and remnants of the dead. The computers inside still functioned, drawing on a hidden atomic power supply that continued to provide energy long after their masters had departed in the chaos before the nukes started to fall and the period of sky dark fell across the world. There was no sky here, dark or otherwise. Only water. Only death. Ryan's brain shifted gears. How had he ended up down here? He was no engineer, but he knew from hard-earned experience that the gateways didn't work like this. He couldn't have been transported into the nothingness of the sea without a Mat-Trans unit, and there was no unit here. Also, even if there had been some sort of freak accident, Ryan knew that some of the others should have accompanied him. Why wouldn't his arms work? They floated aimlessly above his head, not responding to his frantic thoughts of escape. His clothing billowed around him like a parachute, but without providing any resistance. His legs also hung limply. The toes of his boots pointed down like twin anchors, pulling him steadily to the bottom, past the blind eyes of the elongated eel-like creatures that were swimming past, their mouths yawning open as they sifted through the brine for microscopic bits of plankton. Ryan willed his legs to kick, his arms to push down to check his descent, but it was as if he were an old wooden puppet dropped overboard and his strings had been cut. At the rate he was sinking, Ryan knew he'd run out of air long before feeling solid earth beneath his feet. Already, a red haze was starting to settle over his field of vision from lack of oxygen. A coppery, bitter taste filled his mouth, mixing with the traces of salt water. So this is how it ended. Not in a hailstorm of gunfire or in a hand-to-hand knife battle, but underwater and alone.
A man always has a choice. He can either live or he can die.
He heard Traitor's voice, but Traitor was wrong. There was no choice to be made when it came to living or dying. The only choice was in how. His lungs began to ache. Christie's face shone like a beacon in Ryan's mind's eye. He clung to that image, struggled again to make his body work, willing his muscles to pull taut and arrest his descent. Suddenly, in a burst of movement, he was rewarded, with his legs kicking out and his arms pushing down. Even though the adrenaline surge was far too late to save himself now, Ryan fought back as he continued to plummet into the darkness. Lost and alone. Ryan Carter opened his eye. Above him was the face of a crimson-haired angel.
Welcome back, lover. Decide to go for a swim without me?
Come on in. The water's fine.
Ryan tried to pull himself to his feet, but gave up when he realized one of his legs wasn't functioning. A pins and needles sensation was tingling from his left knee to his foot. His leg was asleep, and it felt like he'd been resting on it for a long time.
What happened? What's wrong with the air in here? It's as hot as a triple-stoked blast furnace.
You ended up face down when we jumped in, Dad. This gateway was half full of water. You were almost gone when Christie came out of it and rolled you over.
Listening as Dean spoke, Ryan had observed he was sitting upright in the familiar surroundings of a Matran's chamber, his back against one of the armaglass walls. He was also sitting in approximately 6 inches of filthy water, littered with brackish slime and a thin film of green algae. The next thing he realized was how awful the chamber smelled, and the hellish temperature that surrounded him like a soggy blanket.
Ryan, dear fellow, it warms my heart that once again you're with us.
Ryan knew he had been out of it for a while if Doc Tanner was up and about. Usually Doc suffered the worst after a jump, lapsing into inane babble, as well as experiencing physical ailments such as the nosebleed Dean had suffered, or self-induced bruises and cuts from thrashing about in the chamber after the jump was completed.
Thanks, Doc.
Ryan's left knee still felt like a strand of wet string, but sensation was quickly returning to the limb.
I had one vicious nightmare while I was out. It feels like someone was playing a rowdy game of Bloodstopper with it.
I must say, I've never played that sport. Sounds painful.
Yeah, you don't have the build for it, although you'd probably last longer than I would right now. How come you're looking so good, Doc?
No visions of demon fate, my friend. Other than awakening with my trousers sodden from the water on the chamber floor, my journey was unencumbered by dreams.
None of us experienced the usual nightmares. I'd say our bodies must be getting used to the Matran's process. Except from the look on your face, I'd say you weren't so lucky.
Guess my mind game was enough for all of us.
Ryan quickly sketched a verbal portrait of his unreal underwater experience for his friends.
Gaia, but that's a harsh way to die. Perhaps your subconscious was trying to tell you something.
Yeah, roll over. Figured we'd all come through this okay for a change, except for you.
JB elbowed past Doc.
This was a smooth and easy jump. Hell of a way to die, though, drowning face down in a gateway.
Wasn't my choice. Dying's dying. Once you're chilled, it doesn't matter how or why.
Still a bastard way for a man to cash in.
Well, I have to admit I can think of better ways to go.
Indeed. A most ignoble end for such a brave sort as yourself, my dear fellow.
I wonder...
What?
Well, last time we all came through a Matran's jump without feeling real sick or having the nightmares was back in the Amazonian basin. You know, where the natives thought Jack was a god?
So? What's your point?
So, I wonder if heat has anything to do with easing the effects of the jump. There was no air conditioning working there either, and it was as hot as Hades inside the chamber. But we all felt fine. Maybe heat at the destination site makes the mist less invasive. Listen to me. I'm starting to sound like Mildred. I don't know anything about these Matran's units.
You know just as much as the rest of us. It's a good theory. Even if it doesn't help us out now, it might prove handy sometime down the trail. I wonder where we ended up this time.
JB lifted a hand and swiped at the speckled mold that covered the armaglass walls of the chamber. revealing the surface color underneath to Ryan. The leader of the group stared at the wall for a second, trying to place the color.
I won't need my sextant this time. We're in Florida swamp country. Green glades, if memory serves.
Yeah, I remember these blue-green walls from the last time, too. Give me a hand. I'm tired of sitting in this bastard water.
JB and Christy helped Ryan to his feet. His leg was still tingling as feeling returned. The one-eyed man was silent for a moment as he checked his weapons. The pistol seemed to be none the worse for wear, and he had noticed earlier that Dean was holding the Steyr SSG bolt-action rifle.
Here, Dad. Didn't want it to get wet.
Thanks.
Ryan smiled back at Dean as he carefully opened the gateway door and stepped out into the small anteroom beyond the chamber. The room appeared to have been untouched since last time, except for the increase in mold and dampness. A baseball cap with a torn fastener that Ryan remembered from his previous visit was in one corner, half floating, half submerged in the brackish water on the floor.
The colors of the armor glass in these gateways has always been different shades of the rainbow, no matter where we've ended up. There has been no duplication as yet, for reasons lost to me. Our benefactors were indeed lovers of a wide variety when it came to gateway decoration.
The same didn't apply to the actual layout and furnishing of the redoubts themselves. Like most of the other redoubts they had visited, this one offered row upon row of gunmetal-gray desks holding a vast array of computers. However, this time, there was a major difference. All but a handful of the monitor screens in the control area were dark.
Comps down. It's a wonder we got here.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jack.
Ryan entered the large control room under his own power, grateful that the tingling sensation in his leg was gone. He glanced up and noticed that the strip lights overhead were almost all dark. The ceiling was cracked as well, and showed an array of damage from where water had seeped in from above.
If this is the redoubt in Green Glades, this entire complex has been flooded.
Mildred idly ran a finger over a dirty keyboard. The gritty coating smeared under her touch, revealing the functions of the top row of keys.
I'd say most everything was underwater for hours, maybe even days. And if some of the hardware is still up, I'd have to question the software.
The air in the comp room was damp and humid, but infinitely more breathable than what passed for oxygen in the Mat-Trans unit.
This hole smells like Florida, at any rate.
So where did the water go?
We know from past experience these redoubts are equipped with emergency drains, Dean. The redoubt apparently got rid of the water. Unfortunately for your dad, the gateway chamber didn't.
From the looks of this control room, I wouldn't want to make an attempt at jumping out of this redoubt. I think we should take pains to completely disable the unit. We might not be so lucky on a return visit.
In other words, we could end up back here on another go-round with our eyes where our asshole is supposed to be.
Right. Or with our atoms scattered to the four winds.
For a second, Ryan's mind went back to the green sea he'd experienced during his dream. Undoubtedly, there were worse places to end up than inside one of the Mat-Trans units, atoms scattered or not.
Not that we'd be alive long enough to enjoy the sight. Molecular dissipation and regeneration isn't the most pleasant thing to endure when the Mat-Trans works properly. I'd hate to think about what could go wrong if the receiving unit was malfunctioning. Since we have no control over where we jump, I say let's take this stop off the tour. Permanently.
You forgetting the fail-safes, Millie?
JB referred to the past theory the group held that if a Mat-Trans unit was malfunctioning or incapable of receiving, the computers automatically rerouted the incoming transport to a second location. All of the friends had agreed the nightmares brought on by the jumps were at their worst if this occurred, due to the longer time spent in phase.
No, but we don't have any proof the theory is right, and this dump barely brought us in safely this time.
Mildred idly watched the coded messages dance across the dirty and streaked computer monitor screen as Dean stepped up beside her.
We had a comp back at the school.
Learn anything? Programming? Word processing?
Not much. On, off. Diff between a disk drive and a CD-ROM drawer. One of my buds, Rodney, showed me a game or two. Hot pipe. Let's see. Let's try pushing Control, Alt, Delete.
What the hell did you do, Mildred?
It wasn't me. Look closer to home, Ryan.
Mildred pointed to the ashen-faced Dean.
If that had happened when we were reassembling the Mat-Trans chamber, no safety would have saved our asses. 30-minute automatic reset be damned.
It was an accident!
Is this the way it's gonna be? What, did you lose most of your survival skills during your stay at Brody's? If you have, you're going to get us all chilled real fast.
Sorry, Dad.
Dean started to cut his eyes away from his father's piercing glare until the one-eyed man grabbed the boy by the chin and pulled his face back up.
I know I screwed up, Dad.
Fine. Don't do it again.
Actually, Dean might have solved the question of whether this redoubt's gateway was safe for future use.
Mildred's right. The kid did us a favor. Pushed our luck and then some with this redoubt. If I had any doubts before, this made the decision for me. I'm for walking.
Ryan turned from Dean to look at Mildred and JB.
All right, then. Mildred, you make sure all the Matrans control comps are really dead. We can leave the sector open for extra safety in case something else happens. Close the door when you're through and come out after us. While you're checking the comps, we'll fan out to the stairwell and see about making our way up to the top of the redoubt.
I take it we're here to stay for a while in sunny Florida?
Not much choice about being here now, but I'm not planning on staying. Too damned hot. We'll see what we can find in the quarters above, then head up the coastline and see what we find there. Maybe grab a boat and sail up to the Carolinas.
What about Green Gladesville, Dad? You think any of those crazies are still around? Maybe they're the ones who flooded the place.
I doubt it. After all, I chilled most of the sons of bitches myself.
Green Glades. A wellspring of bad memories came back to Ryan. Memories of Fat Boss Larry Zapp atop his padded throne, overlooking his over-the-top conceptville of brightly colored rides and attractions. What did Mildred call the place then? A theme park. A place of lights and sounds, where families went for fun and excitement, with sugary sweets to eat and trinkets for prizes for children. A land of make-believe. A land of amusement. Only things hadn't been too amusing when they had passed through. Not that it was Larry Zapp's fault. He could have taken them out when they arrived in the villa if he'd wanted, and the overweight Baron did have reason enough to want to see Ryan Cotter dead. A younger Ryan and J.B. Dix had crossed paths with Larry in his pre-Baron days, during their time riding shotgun for the traitor on Warwag 1. Ryan knew their encounter had been unforgettable for Larry, who was the owner of a large and successful traveling gaudy, and the half-dozen or so sluts inside. Cold beer and hot women was Larry's motto, and he was doing fine with his touring group, until he got greedy and tried to bribe one of the Warwag's crewmen with a one-eared whore named Bernice. The trader's stockpiles of guns, ammo, and fuel were legendary, and the pimp had sought a direct source to the goods. Sex and beer were profitable, but fuel and weapons were shining gold. When the trader found out about Larry's scheme, his response was predictable. He sent his two most trusted henchmen to teach Larry a lesson in manners. After Ryan and JB's not-so-friendly visit, the wags Larry had used for the gaudy were burned-out wrecks of twisted metal, the casks of golden-tinged beer were poured out on the dirt, and the gaily-painted girls had been threatened and fled for their very lives into the nearby hills as fast as their high-heeled feet would carry them. All this while Larry had gotten extra special care. As his employees ran, Larry had received a beating that left him broken and bleeding in the mud, with both elbows bent backward in the most painful position possible, but at least he was alive. Barely. Luckily enough, nearly a dozen years had passed since his youthful indiscretion, and Larry didn't hold a grudge. Ryan wasn't proud of what he'd done to a tub of guts like Larry way back when, but the man had brought it on himself. The Baron had gestured with one flabby arm and granted them safe harbor, telling his sec man to give the group back their blasters and full access to the park and attractions. Larry invited them to stay and enjoy what the Ville had to offer, which unfortunately included a sick bastard named Adam Traven, a self-styled cult leader who had arrived in Green Glades 3 months prior to Ryan and his group. Traven had his own noble young group of followers who shared his perverted murderous fantasies. Fantasies Doc found out about the hard way, when a young lady named Sky had tried to strangle him during a bout of lovemaking. Traven had also arrived with a large supply of the highly addictive and very rare form of jolt known as Dream, and wasted no time in hooking the hedonistic boss Larry on the fine pink powder. To further cement Larry's dependency, Traven had also unleashed on the fat man all the sexual excess his teenage followers could provide. A sec man named Kelly had told Ryan that Green Gladesville had once been a paradise, with working television and air conditioning, and some of the best food a man could ever hope to see before him on a plate. The restored attractions were a hobby, something to show off to visitors. Boss Larry was a regular techno brain, a genius with electronics, who loved wine, women, and song. Until the drugs ate away at his brain. That was none of Ryan's business. In one day, two tops, his party would be on their way, and Larry Zapp, Baron of Greengladesville, could snort until his fat head exploded. But nothing was ever that simple in Deathlands, and Ryan was forced to become actively involved when Traven expressed a more than passing interest in Dean. Larry himself had warned Ryan to keep the boy away from Traven.
Adam likes him, Ryan. Oh, yes. Precious. His precious, Ryan. Boy, he's young and pretty. It's what he wants most.
It was at that moment that Ryan Carter had made the conscious decision that Adam Traven was going to have to die. Not because the sick twist was a control freak and a master manipulator into dominance and submission with a taste for young boys. No, a man's vices were his own. Where Adam Traven had gone wrong was bringing Dean's name into it. After earlier skirmishes, the final battle had come inside the tall observation tower that overlooked Boss Larry's domain. Larry had proved true blue in the end when he had willed his 450-pound body to topple forward and crush the slender, effeminate Traven beneath his magnificent bulk in a violent showdown. By the time Ryan had dragged Traven out, the self-styled cult leader was nearly smothered to death. His skinny body was slick with blood from the 8 rounds he'd pumped into Larry from underneath, but the huge boss hadn't budged. After pulling Traven free, Ryan helped the self-proclaimed master along to Judgment Day with some well-placed bullets from his own gun. Larry Zapp had been the genius behind Greengladesville. With his passing, Ryan expected the theme park to have fallen into complete disrepair.
What kind of name is Larry for a baron anyway?
It could have been worse. He could have been Boss Mo, or Boss Curly, or God help us all, Boss Shemp.
Everyone in the room looked at her blankly.
I must admit, madam, that your reference is arcane, even to one as learned as I. Who is this Boss Shemp?
Forget it. Too silly to try and explain. Seeing is believing when it comes to the Stooges. Mama never could understand why I thought they were so funny. Of course, most women didn't care for their unique brand of comedic talent. Maybe we'll find one of their old comic vids someday, and I can show you.
They were clowns?
No, they were Stooges.
Sometimes, Millie, I don't understand you at all.
JB walked past Mildred until he faced the steel sectors at the end of the control room. The small man raised his weapon in a combat-ready stance and turned back at Ryan for the nod.
You up for this?
Feeling better all the time. Everybody stay alert. I doubt there's anything out there, but this is no time to get sloppy.
Dad?
What?
I used to always open the sect doors, remember?
Ryan looked at JB.
Fine by me.
Okay, son. Go ahead.
The green lever that was present in almost all of the gateways was in the down position, showing that the doors were locked shut. Dean grabbed the lever. When the door was 2 feet off the ground, Dean dropped to his knees and carefully peered out.
Nothing. Corridor's clear.
Ryan took the lead, and the others joined him in stepping outside the doorway, finding themselves in a wide curving passage with an arched roof. It was about 20 feet wide, and the ceiling was roughly 15 feet at the highest point. Concealed strip lighting flickered, casting gray shadows across the expanse of the corridor. When they had last traveled along this passageway, things were deserted, but still in order. The same mold and signs of water damage that had been inside the Mattrans control room were also evident here. Ryan glanced back over his shoulder. A familiar sign to all of the gateway travelers announced, "Entry absolutely forbidden to all but B-12 cleared personnel." The warning hung lopsidedly in a broken frame next to the door.
I'll take the point. Christy, you're behind me. Then Dean, Doc, and Jack.
I'll bring up the rear.
Phew, hot.
The interior of the redoubt was much warmer than before, and Ryan knew it wasn't going to get any cooler as they approached the way outside.
Some fresh air would be nice, lover. I'm about to roast in my boots.
Less than 2 minutes later, the party faced a huge pair of sec doors that stretched from floor to ceiling. The decorator's choice of color for the doors was a shade of green that reminded Ryan for a moment of the dream he'd experienced while jumping. Sea green. Before seeing the ocean for the first time, Ryan had been under the fallacy that the waters were blue.
Nothing's ever what it seems in Deathlands.
He stared at the small control panel of letters and numbers for the vanadium steel sec doors then punched in the usual code of 352 and waited for the door to respond.
Dad, you want me
to... Quiet, son. I think you've done enough for one day, don't you? Everyone stay ready. Triple red. We still don't know what's behind this door.
Ryan had half expected to see trapped water pour in, but was relieved to see Mildred's hypothesized flood had passed on. Beyond the doors was an identical passage, except that this one was damaged even more. The floor was littered with cracks, ranging in size from hairline to 3 feet across. Evidence of a past onslaught of water was visible, but so was structural damage and chunks of debris. The room was nightmarish in the flickering light of the damaged tubes, making movement seem slower in the steady strobe. The concrete walls, normally cool and dry to the touch, felt warm and damp. Either something had happened above in Green Glades, or the redoubt had been discovered by parties unknown, who had blasted their way inside. Neither scenario was one Ryan found comforting. Above them, along the arched roof, were sec vids, but the rectangular cameras were dead. Before, the little gadgets had been quite active, tracking their every step with tiny red electronic eyes.
Automatics are down. Last time we triggered them when we stepped out into the corridor.
Explains the heat. What juice is left in this redoubt must be on bare life support. Emergency lights and oxygen, and that's about it. No extra power for air conditioning.
Ryan turned and looked at Mildred.
The farther along we get, the more I have to agree with you, Mildred. This place has completely shot its wad.
The companions made their way slowly down the dirty corridor to a slight bend, which would then lead around to where the stairs and elevator would normally be in the standard redoubt layout.
Phew, bad smell.
Ugh, right on. This goes beyond mildew and moisture. Smells like rotting meat.
Not much longer now. As I recall, around this corner is...
The sound from underfoot stopped him short. On the floor in front of him was a human arm, curled back at a broken angle around the corner. Ryan held up a warning hand for the others to wait, and glanced around the side, darting his head out, then back to safety like the tongue of a snake. In the brief look he'd gotten, he'd seen that the arm was attached to a corpse, face down on the dirty floor. Ryan had stepped on one of the dead man's pasty, brittle hands with his right boot.
Lock and load, people. There's more of them chilled around the bend.
Dark night.
Ryan swung the Sig Sauer around the corner, peering intently along the line of sight. The wide room on the line to the elevators looked pretty much as he remembered, except for the new addition of a mass of rubble that had fallen down from above, twisting the staircase into an unclimbable mass of metal and totally blocking the ruin of a stairwell. The flat landing area at the top, which contained the doorway to the second stairwell, was also wrecked and jammed with broken concrete.
All clear.
As they came around the corner one by one, Mildred took note of three more bodies, all in twisted postures, with small entry and large exit wounds.
Well, we know this wasn't due to rat poisoning, like we've seen take down stiffs and other redoubts. They're not in military uniforms, and they all died from gunshot wounds. From the condition of the bodies, the look of the skin, and the heavenly aroma, I guess these boys have been getting ripe for at least a month or more.
This just keeps getting better and better. How did these guys get down here in the first place?
And who chilled them?
Chilled each other. Trapped. Had an argument. The way the bodies followed in positions, they got in a fight, and everybody lost.
Give me a hand here, John.
Mildred was kneeling, attempting to turn over one of the corpses. The armorer complied, and together they flipped the body onto its back. The sight would have been sickening to most, but it was a familiar one to all of the group. They'd looked down on many a dead man during the time they'd traveled together. The corpse's features were nothing special. Flat nose, thin lips, hair that appeared to have been dyed blonde, but now had a greenish tinge. He looked like 100 other dead men Ryan had seen over the years. He wore a black leather jacket with lots of tarnished buckles, a red t-shirt, jeans, and brown boots. The only unusual thing was a patch sewn on the front breast pocket of the jacket. It was round and about 2 inches in circumference. The entire circle was black, with a white patch in the center.
Looks like a skull wearing a cycle helmet.
Yeah, but check the eyes. There are these little red dots in the eye sockets.
Looks like Jack wearing a cycle helmet then.
Screw cycles. 2 wheels, good way to get shot.
Jack eyed the patch.
Don't look like me.
Sure it does. Just picture yourself with your hair all tucked up under the helmet.
I wonder what it means. I checked out the others. All 4 of these tubes have that same patch. 2 on a jacket, one on the back pocket of a pair of jeans and another on a neckerchief. They must have been together at one time, until somebody drew down on somebody else.
Hot pipe, Dad! We're in luck!
Dean was standing at the elevator, but the boy wasn't alone. Next to the youth, Doc was focused on the black elevator call button.
Young Dean is right, my dear fellow. The elevator appears to be operating, and I do believe it is currently on this floor of the redoubt.
The rest of the group approached for a closer look. The recessed button was indeed lit and glowing.
Shall I put my best finger forward?
After getting the nod from Ryan, Doc pressed the call button for the elevator. The doors obligingly slid open, revealing the empty, coffin-like cabin inside.
I guess no one wants off this floor. Last stop to oblivion.
None of the group ever relished stepping into a redoubt's elevator. Too many things could go wrong. Too many things had gone wrong. Still, it was the most direct way up and out. The dull gray walls offered scant comfort, but they promised access to the surface, a promise that was enticing despite the danger.
After you, ladies.
Thanks, I think.
Ryan glanced a final time over his shoulder and placed himself in the last clear spot at the front of the elevator car.
Going up?
Why not? But when we reach the top, I want everyone on triple red.
Doc, by nature of his position in front of the controls, had taken on the unofficial role of elevator operator for this trip. He pressed the up button.
Wonder what took out the stairs, Dad?
Good question. I was wondering that myself.
High explosives, maybe. Or I guess there could have been a quake around here. Even swamplands aren't safe from earthquakes. Not anymore.
Overhead, the fluorescent tubes flickered once, twice. Sparks filtered down from above as the elevator car shuddered. As the last spark fell brightly to the floor and died, the confined room went dark.
Fire blast. The elevator's out. Everybody stay still. Give your eyes time to adjust.
No place to go but up.
I know. We're gonna have to climb out of the car.
It is sweatbox in here. Go out. Climb quick.
Dean? Come over here. Let me give you a boost. I want you to feel along the upper panels of the ceiling. There should be some kind of an access hatch.
Ryan squinted. Vague shapes were beginning to become apparent in the gloom. His son shifted position with Christy and Jack and ended up standing next to him. Ryan knelt and cupped his hands, offering a step onto his back for the boy. Dean placed one foot in his father's hands and used his hands to brace himself on the knotted muscles of Ryan's shoulders. Ryan waited as Dean felt around the roof.
Got it!
Good. Now come on down. JB?
You going up?
Not much of a choice. Dean opened the door. Now I've got to take a look outside.
Ryan removed a tight pair of black gloves from one of his long coat's pockets, then shrugged out of the garment. Carefully, he also took off his long white scarf with the weighted ends and bundled it up into a tight ball. The extra clothing would just get in the way of what he was about to do.
Here, Christy. I'll be back for these in a minute.
JB leaned down and interlocked his fingers together as a stepping stone. The armorer lifted as Ryan extended his arms above his head, gripped the edge of the hatch Dean had opened, and pulled himself up and out of the car. Half of Ryan still dangled down into the cabin, but from the waist up he was exposed to the four walls of the elevator shaft. As inside the car, the lighting out there was non-existent, but he was surprised to see glowing fluorescence extending vertically up the far back wall. As he gazed at the glow, Ryan realized he was looking at a pattern. He pulled himself completely through the hatch and managed to brace himself along one of the sturdy upper beams of the elevator, not wanting to test the strength of the ceiling with his weight. Ryan looked at the glow-in-the-dark shapes stretching up along the wall of the shaft. What he was seeing were the rungs of an emergency ladder, no doubt designed for just this kind of happenstance. The rungs were evenly spaced about 2 feet apart, one after the other, and bolted into place. They snaked up as far as Ryan could see.
What's the situation?
There's an emergency ladder in place along the front wall of the shaft. We'll go up in two groups. You, me, and Christy will wreck upstairs. After we've cleared the area, then Mildred, Doc, Dean, and Jack can come up. We'll have to do this one at a time. I don't want to put too much weight on the top of the car, or if anybody accidentally fall off. Go in order of how we usually approach a triple red situation.
From within the elevator, JB assisted Christy up. Once the red-haired beauty was safe, Ryan took to the ladder, giving enough room on the elevator roof for the armorer to scramble up safely. The climb was smooth and easy. At a few points, the rungs were slippery with old grease and grime, but it was nothing Ryan couldn't handle. When he reached the end of the ladder and realized he was staring at a hairline crack where the top floor elevator shaft doors opened, he was almost surprised.
We're here.
Good.
I'll have to force the shaft doors. Hold on until I signal you.
Ryan used the panga to help open the doors, sliding the finely honed blade into the thin slit, then twisting his wrist back and forth. Ryan had crooked one arm through the rung for extra support, but that limited the amount of pressure he could put on the knife. Christy, seeing Ryan's predicament, made her way up next to him. She pressed her firm body against his own to help hold him firmly in place, with her chest against his back as she reached out on either side and gripped the rungs of the ladder tightly.
Looked like you needed an assist, lover. Be careful up there. Something doesn't feel right.
What? Squatters living in the redoubt like those bastard twins back in old Colorado?
Could be that. Our friends of the four men we found below.
Ryan nodded. With Christy's support, he was now free to use his full upper body strength against the closed doors. Ryan created a space just wide enough for a man to slip through. Balancing his feet on the top rung of the emergency ladder, Ryan used the upper part of the now open door for a handhold. He stepped through to what he hoped was safety. The area outside the elevator was as dim as the darkness in the shaft. The electricity was apparently out up here as well. Ryan paused, straining his eye and scanning for any signs of movement. Nothing. He took one step forward, and a piece of straight plastic snapped underfoot. Ryan dived away from the doors for cover, hoping the noise would keep Christy and JB in place on the ladder and not drive them into doing anything heroic. An empty plastiform and steel cargo container was lying open on one side. Ryan took cover behind it. Since he was still alive, Ryan figured the shooter didn't have infrared. His guess was that the assailant had been forced to aim by sound, using noises to track as Ryan slipped out the doors from the elevator shaft. Ryan crouched on his hands and knees behind the container and waited. The bursts of gunfire were reassuring. Ryan now knew for a fact that he could safely discount a night scope by the way the bullets kept ineptly chewing up the scenery. The sniper was firing blind. Ryan kept his head low, listening, attempting to pinpoint the exact location of the gunman. Obviously, the shooter was firing from a vantage point located around a corner of the walkway, across from the elevator. While this was a safe place to hide for an ambush, it also meant that the sniper's aim was compromised. In one practiced move, Ryan unleathered the Sig Sauer and waited. The way his hidden assailant had been spraying ammo, Ryan deduced that the shooter had to be reloading. Ryan reached down and, as before, carefully, quietly, picked up a handful of the scattered bits of discarded rock and metal on the floor, gracefully overhanding them toward a mass of empty storage pods to his right. The response was sloppy, but Ryan was used to stoops who let weapons do their thinking in a combat situation. Ryan had easily placed the shooter by ear. Now all he wanted was a final visual confirmation, which came soon enough as the M16 spit a fresh hail of bullets. This time, Ryan clearly saw the white flash from the barrel of the weapon, and Ryan brought his own weapon to bear.
Ryan?
Shh! Not yet.
Ryan stood and walked warily to the fallen body. As he had hoped, the sniper had been alone. He looked down impassively on the slain killer, striking a match while kneeling for a close inspection. The tight circle of light revealed a thin man of about 30, with dirty, long blonde hair and a ratty goatee. The dead man wore a powder blue dress shirt that had already turned dark with blood from his wounds. A pair of combat boots had the cuffs of baggy, dirty trousers stuffed into their high tops. On the pocket of the shirt was a black and white skull patch, identical to the ones on the sleeves and pockets of the corpses on the lower floor of the redoubt. Ryan was getting ready to tell Christy to come through the elevator access hatch when the interior of the redoubt lit up. Ryan squinted, his vision distorted with tiny explosions of color from his single overloaded cornea. As he blinked, Ryan grimly realized that he was temporarily in the same blind position of the dead sniper. He reached out and retrieved the man's rifle. Hearing the approaching footsteps, he crawled in the opposite direction back toward the oversized cargo container. Temporarily safe for a second time behind the makeshift cover, he listened, waiting for his best opportunity, depending on who or what came around the corner.
Jeez, this joint makes me nervous.
Everything makes you nervous, bro. Gambling makes you nervous. Goddess sluts make you nervous. I say take advantage of anything you can and go for the moment. Use your nerves, man.
Whatever you say, Dunlop. I just wish I'd get assigned to something more exciting than hiding out and guarding an empty shithole. Oh, Christ, look at this! What a bastard mess!
His vision now back to normal, Ryan peered out from behind his haven and took in the scene. The man with the slight Cajun accent had to be Dunlop. He was a tall black man with a mass of thick dreadlocks sticking out in all directions atop his sweaty face. He was dressed in baggy, ill-fitting pants and a patched tie-dyed t-shirt that read, All Night Funk Machine, in silver iron-on letters. A white headband stretched across his forehead. In its center was the skull patch.
Makes a convenient target.
The black man also carried an M16, identical to the one the slain man had been using. The other man, or rather the other boy, Bro, was white, and wore a red flannel shirt open in the front, black jeans, and a threadbare pair of white canvas tennis shoes that were now splattered with crimson from where he'd stepped into the growing pool of blood leaking from the slain sniper's shattered cranium. Sunglasses with darkened lenses were perched high on the forehead of his moon pie face. He looked every bit of 15 years old. His hair was cut close and stood up on his scalp like freshly shorn wheat. The shirt and jeans were too short, and his youngster's wrists and sockless ankles were showing. Ryan guessed that the boy hadn't had a change of clothing in some time, and was rapidly growing out of what attire he owned. An H&K 32 automatic was gripped tightly in his right hand.
He's dead then, is he?
What do you think? Half his damn head's gone.
Poor Mikey. He dead. Scared of a little blood.
Dunlop used the toe of one foot to nudge the dead man.
Ah, got to grow up sometime, little one. Here's some free advice. Try not to step in it. Shit will stick to your shoes like a hot glue. Lucky for your delicate nose, Mikey here is done deader than dick. And not long dead. Otherwise, he'd be stinking a whole lot worse than usual in this heat.
Who do you think did him?
Don't know. Guess the boss knew someone might be coming back here sooner or later. Otherwise, he wouldn't have bothered posting guards. Lucky break for you, man.
Lucky break how?
Could be you chilled there on the floor. I walked out here with you from camp as a favor. What if you found such a terrible sight alone, eh? Wet your pants and come back crying for help. Too bad Mikey couldn't handle it better than this, though. This stupid son of a bitch.
Man, Mike was cool, man. Ease up.
Sure, sure. Look. He's been made, too.
How do you know that?
His gun's gone, stoop. Unless the man's weapon decided to run for cover. Somebody beat us to turning him over.
You're right.
Whoa, shit, shit.
Dunlop swung his M16 around and prepared to fire. Bro merely stood there, not making a sound. His right cheek and head were spotted with red, but he made no move to wipe the gore from his face. The only noticeable change in his composure was how pale his head suddenly looked, sticking out of the open collar of the flannel shirt. A slight sheen of sweat covered his ears. He kept his hands low and at waist level.
So much for the funk machine. I'm hoping you're smarter.
Compared to those two, I already am. I'm still alive.
For the time being. Drop the blaster now before I chill you too.
Ryan stepped forward to kick the pistol away when the nervous Bro decided to make a move. Blood and drool mixed with bits of white enamel poured from the young man's ruined mouth.
Listen close. I don't like liars, and I like liars with knives even less. I've been on the defensive since walking into this scum-soaked hole, and I don't even know who you losers are or why you're lurking around here. So spill it.
Bro stared dully at Ryan. All of the white heat of the attack had been doused with a taste of cold steel against his now bleeding gums.
Who are you?
Who I am doesn't matter. Talk to me, boy, and make the story interesting.
We're part of the Northern Panhandle, Sex Squad of Three. We were sent here to keep an eye on this place.
Sex Squad? Well, that explains the twin M16s and utter lack of training in using them, I suppose. Who trained you?
Rollins. Rollins trained me personally back at the barracks in Mobile.
Alabama?
Yeah. Yeah, he trained me good. I'm a professional.
So tell me, professional, what's up with the skull patches?
All of Rollins' men wear them.
Who is this Rollins?
The boy clammed up. Ryan gestured with a pistol.
Do I have to shoot you in the leg to help your memory?
Rollins is the boss of all bosses. He's going to take over Deathlands someday.
Oh, King of the Deathlands. Now there's a title for you. How'd you get in here anyway?
Through the door, you old fart.
Watch your smart mouth, stoop.
This place was open. It's been open for months. Doors were broken in a crack. You should know. You had to have...
Then Bro's gaze fell on the partially opened elevator. and a look of understanding fell across his face. His eyes narrowed suspiciously.
You came down from below!
Good eyes. Wrong assumption. There's no elevator there, just an empty shaft. I was in here already. Came through Greenglades Park. Got lost in the swamps. After I nearly had one of my feet gnawed off by a muty frog, I decided to look in here for some shelter. How old are you?
15.
You got any folks?
Got an older sister.
Any message you want sent after I've chilled your flannel-wearing ass?
Fuck you!
I can spell that. She can chisel it on your tombstone.
Ryan raised the muzzle of the Sig Sauer and pointed it directly between the boy's eyes.
I guess I have no choice. Turn around and start running. And don't stop until you're long out of Florida.
You'll shoot me in the back!
If I was going to chill you, I would have done it already. Now scram.
But my blaster!
Wrong. My blaster. And I have your balls as a keepsake, too, if you don't pack up and roll out of here. Now go on! Get out of my sight!
Bro glared back at Ryan for a few seconds, his face a mix of fear and distrust. Ryan holstered the Sig Sauer and stepped back to the elevator. Christy was already up and out. She looked around the corridor at the bodies among the debris.
And I thought this redoubt couldn't get any sorrier.
We need to move. That kid may be back with Buddy soon.
You let him go.
That's right. So?
Why?
Why not? Only a scared boy running with the big dogs. There's been enough chilling for one day. Besides, by the time he gets back to wherever he's headed to tell about discovering us inside, we'll be long gone.
You saw Dean, didn't you? You took a long look and saw your own son perched at the receiving end of a blaster and you couldn't blow him away.
Ryan kept silent and turned away, walking over to the elevator. He peered down in the darkness of the shaft and waved at a shadowy JB, who had continued to cling patiently to the ladder and wait for a signal.
About freaking time.
On the other side of the forced open elevator doors were the remains of the ransacked redoubt. During the group's first pass through this complex many months earlier, the rooms on the upper floor had offered a safe haven with food, clothing, weaponry, and ammunition. This time, there was nothing for the travelers but utter devastation. The walls of the compact redoubt were cracked and blackened with soot and bullet holes from random firings or disagreements such as the one glimpsed between the four dead men below. Evidence of cooking fires could be seen on the floor, ashes mixed with dirty water that stood on the floor in shallow puddles. In the sleeping areas, the dormitories were ransacked. All bedding had been stolen or ruined. Only a few skeletal bed frames remained. The dining area and kitchens were in the same condition, and all of the supply larders were empty, their steel shelves barren of any cans or boxes. The freezers were also clean, each of them offering nothing but a few inches of foul-smelling water in the bottom catch pans and long emptied steel cans and paper boxes. Although the failing power supply would probably have ruined any unused frozen edibles, everyone's stomachs still ached for the loss. No tinned ham or recon eggs or cans of beans and self-heat blueberry muffins this time around, nor would there be fresh clothing or new weapons and ammunition. This redoubt's treasures had been plundered, removed, squandered. No dry clothing or toiletry supplies was one thing. An absence of a decent haven to lie down and rest one's weary head and body was another. But the absence of food was the most disappointing of all.
No grub. Shit.
Well said, Jack. Well said.
Damn, I'm starved, Dad.
We all are, son.
This place was swept clean.
JB was walking back from the empty redoubt armory and shooting range.
There isn't anything left worth taking, which leads to the obvious question.
Why were there guards posted in an empty redoubt?
Who knows? Pride? An overinflated sense of security?
Or maybe this Rollins boss the kid told me about expected visitors from down below. And that's why the elevator was sabotaged. Blow out the steps and there isn't any other way into the lower levels of the redoubt, except for where they had a guard at the top of the shaft. And in through the back door by using the Mat-Trans unit.
You think Rollins knew about the Mat-Trans chamber?
Hell, JB, these gateways aren't the great secret they used to be. Even back when we first hooked up with Trader, he knew about the redoubts. And there were always rumors floating around about some kind of magic, super-scientific transportation devices hidden inside.
However, there was no way they could have entered the Mat-Trans control room without the access codes. But all the warning signs and other sec bullshit stationed around the door would have been a tip-off that there was something big in there.
Maybe word about the redoubts is starting to spread among the general population, Lover. Once a secret like this starts to travel...
Right.
Next thing you know, we're walking out of gateway chambers and into the waiting ambushes of scavengers.
Well, there's nothing here worth taking, so let's get out.
The walk to the main access door of the redoubt took only seconds. Ryan and the others saw that the blonde youth had spoken the truth. A big hole replaced the vanadium steel-reinforced sector, which had been capable of withstanding a direct hit from a nuke.
Dark night.
I'd say whoever came through here last didn't bother to knock.
The friends stood together in front of the remains of the sector and stared out through the gaping hole into the green of the world. Waves of warm, damp air wafted out over them. Even with his long jacket and weighted white scarf off, Ryan felt a new patch of sweat start to spread across his lower back. They'd all be smelling ripe soon enough in this climate. Green Glades was just as Ryan remembered it, lush and beautiful, and as humid as hell. And this time, there was an added bonus.
Raining.
Gaia, but it's hot.
Christy reached her arms behind her neck and grasped fistfuls of her long red hair in her hands. She began to twist the hair into a makeshift bun to keep it off her neck. Dean slapped at an insect.
Ow! Little shit!
Get used to it. We're gonna be slogging through this mess for a while. And watch your language. You've been cussing more than I do. Didn't Brody teach you manners in that school of his?
Yes, sir. Taught me plenty. But he didn't teach me not to cuss.
Funny. I thought manners were on the agenda. Leastways they were when I dropped you off there at the school.
A lack of vocabulary is nothing to take pride in, young Cawdor.
Words is words, Doc. Why use big ones when the little ones will do?
Ryan had to grin in spite of himself at that bit of logic. Even Doc was speechless.
Out of the mouths of babes, Doc. But I'd appreciate your taking more care, Dean. For my sake.
Okay, Christy.
JB examined one of the broken sides of the doorway where the vanadium steel sector would normally have been entrenched.
Somebody wanted in here bad.
What do you think they used?
A tow, maybe. It's portable enough to bring into the swamps and has enough kick. I'd say it would have to be some type of heavy anti-tank gear. Or a mortar. Might have taken a dozen or so hits to do the job. But apparently they weren't too worried about shaking up the interior since this redoubt was already quake damaged.
That's how they were able to get in without a code. They huffed and they puffed and they blew the house in.
Yeah. We know these redoubts were built tough enough to withstand a lot of punishment, but even they can't hold up long against an earthshaker. After the quake did the structural damage, whoever wanted in kept hammering at the door. You hammer long enough, knowing the walls were already cracked...
They brought down the walls of Jericho. As you were telling young Dean earlier, nobody has any manners these days. Still, these redoubts were built with the taxpayers' money. I suppose all have the God-given right to use them as they please.
Doc was right. The group of travelers had grown to become somewhat possessive of the hidden redoubts, and they were far from masters of the technology inside. Mildred had once said the places were like a sick version of their home away from home. Like the old-fashioned motel chains of her youth, all of the redoubts tended to be alike, from city to city and state to state. Since Ryan's group was in many ways nomadic, traveling from point to point with no real destination, perhaps the doctor was right. Perhaps the redoubts were indeed becoming home. The mass of green outside smelled of damp.
Looked like home. Pretty.
Well, that's right, Jack. You weren't with us last time we set foot out here.
No. It was back in New Mexico, Dan. With Christina.
Christy immediately sensed a shift in the albino's entire mental aura. The mention of his late wife had caused her memory to leap back into his mind and drop him into an even deeper funk than the glum albino normally wore as a shield against the world. It was almost like a purple shroud had suddenly enveloped his entire body, a shroud only Jack could feel, and only Christy, by virtue of her mutant abilities, could see.
Oh, Jack,
No, I not forget her. Never forget. He not your fault, Christy.
Christy smiled gratefully at Jack, but still mentally cursed herself. She knew that Jack cherished the memories of his time spent at peace at the New Mexico ranch. Until their untimely deaths, the young man had experienced the kind of love with his wife and child that only a family can bring. For a short time, Jack Lauren had known the peace of having a place of his own, away from the constant death and violence, and Christy envied him for it.
Where to, leader man?
Straight ahead to the farthest star and take a left to morning.
JB, what do you think?
Not much point in going west. That's where the Cajuns were camping out last. If we stay on the path we took before, we'll end up inside the park.
At least we're familiar with the layout there. We'll go that way until we see or hear something to convince me otherwise.
They passed by the shredded remains of an animated Zulu warrior and his rhino companion outside the redoubt's doorway. On their previous visits, when they had first ventured outside, Ryan had stepped on a trigger switch that brought the pair to life. In retaliation, his companions had laid down a hail of bullets so fast that Ryan had barely enough time to hit the grass. Androids. Part of the attractions at Green Glades theme park. What was left of the pair had now fallen prey to the growth of the swamp, the heavy rains, and the earthquakes. Both warrior and rhino were completely enveloped by tendril-like green vines. If Ryan hadn't known where to look, he never would have spotted the pair a second time.
You know, now that we're not out here with our guns blazing away at those droids, something just occurred to me.
What's that, Mildred?
I wonder why this redoubt was located in the middle of a swamp that served as a public site for family amusement. I doubt Matt Tran's units were listed on the official See and Do itinerary.
Perhaps it was a way of getting the top political bosses and their families into the park unseen. Security for government leaders has always been a problem whenever the power elite took a notion to mingle with the common folk.
True. The first family could step into a chamber in Washington and in less than a minute appear here. Want to suck up to a senator? Bring him down south. Got a major conglomerate head you want to grease? Impress him with a magic visit to Florida. The same could apply to visiting foreign dignitaries and heads of state. I mean, what better way to impress a Russian or Chinese leader than to transport them into the fantasy kingdom of Green Glades Park for a night of fun and games?
That's all well and good, but you're forgetting that the redoubts and the Matrans units were supposed to be top secret. I doubt any leaders were shuttling in the wife and kids for a day's entertainment at government expense, unless he was the big boss or something.
Ryan, you'd be surprised.
Well, this redoubt was stuck in here because Green Glades offered the perfect cover. They probably included the redoubt blueprints and the ones for the park, then built them at the same time. Never been any logic to where the totality concept placed their Matrans units.
You got a point.
One day I'd like to meet the stoop bastard who came up with all the stuff the totality concept had their fingers in.
Ryan was surprised. His friend rarely expressed much of an interest in anything beyond weapons.
Why?
It'd be my greatest honor to personally chill him, or her.
The rain was the worst possible kind to have to endure. JB had given up on trying to keep his glasses clear, and now walked resolutely at the back of the group, depending more on sound and his own combat-honed senses than his vision. He thought about just taking his glasses off, but his poor eyesight had quickly changed his mind. Better to be half-blind than completely in a blurry haze. The entire group was miserable. Some, like Ryan, had taken off a layer of their outer clothing, while others, such as Doc, kept fully dressed. Neither method offered true relief, since bare skin offered up a banquet to the small darting mosquitoes that had bitten Dean back at the redoubt, while keeping covered was like having to march in a blast furnace while wrapped in a mass of sodden quilts.
Ugh, hard to believe anyone would want to come to this hellhole for vacation.
As I recall, madam, the young and the old flocked to Florida for the scenic beaches and tanning rays of the sun, not the steady drizzle or the state's varied swamplands.
Give me the mountains any day of the week.
Hold up.
Ryan had been following the slowly moving river, looking for some kind of a landmark they might remember from before. Nothing as obvious as a sign or a chained-off area presented itself, but ahead of them was a huge fallen tree made of fiberglass and plastic, part of the park's once carefully cultivated veneer. The path Ryan had been following vanished beneath the fake redwood, and an even denser growth of bushes lay beyond.
Used to be a bridge here, stretched out clean across the water.
And boats! All kinds of plastic boats with ripped-up roofs and funny names.
Queen of the South. I recall that was one of the poor stranded hulks. But where the sad queen and all of her familiars have vanished, I cannot say.
Bridge probably fell in the quake, and those boats weren't exactly secure.
Doesn't matter. I recognize the tree.
Alas, even the mighty redwoods cannot withstand the power of the land.
Sure, Doc, whatever. All right, this spot here is close to where the sec man Kelly got the drop on his first time we came through. This visit, I think we'll try and be a little more subtle until we see what the situation is.
You think folks still here?
Could be. One thing we do know is that many of the people living in the Ville were chilled in the fight with Traven. And my guess is with Larry dead, there wouldn't be reason to hang around this place for long once the rides went down and the electricity messed up.
Debate as you will, friends. I'm going to fetch a drink.
Doc headed for the shallow edge of the riverbank.
I am frightfully parched.
Mildred, any chance of this water being drinkable?
No reason it shouldn't be.
Mildred turned after the departing Doc.
My advice is to be more worried about what's in the water.
You got a point, Mildred. JB, go with Doc. Keep an eye out for snakes. If the water's okay, we can refill our ration canteens.
The armorer nodded and followed Doc to the edge of the slowly moving water. Standing near his father, Dean looked a little uncomfortable at the mention of snakes. Since he had nearly had the life squeezed out of him by a multi-hued mutated boa constrictor in his previous visit to this section of Green Glades.
You thirsty, Dean?
No, I think I'll stay right where I am, Dad.
Be nice to go skinny dipping in there, lover. Take the edge off this wet heat. After sweating for so long in the redoubt, then stomping around all afternoon in this fetid mess, I'm sure all of us could use a dunking.
I hear you. But I think I'd rather go for a swim when the rain stops.
Ah!